Okay, last time on page 95, we had just talked about those of us who have the capability of accomplishing things in the world. And it says in the middle of page 95, for example, God gives one person a little extra brain power, making him capable of running a big business and therefore living comfortably. Should he be prideful for having achieved this? No, for if God were to abandon him for even a little while, he might become bankrupt and go to prison. He who has talents but lacks humility and troubles his neighbor with his provocative behavior compels Christ to take the small screwdriver and loosen his screws a bit in order to humble him against his will. And then over on the next page, page 96. What the fuck?
God taking a screwdriver and loosening our screws a little bit.
I know exactly what he's saying, though, right?
It doesn't, because we're not working right. You're not supposed to work like that. And he applies it also. He says God takes, at the top of page 96, God takes the screwdriver and, let's just read this. Let's say someone wants to dig a large boulder out of the ground and is struggling with it because he lacks the ingenuity to figure out a way to move it. Smarter fellow approaches him and says, "You foolish man, don't you know how to move that rock?" So he takes a long crowbar, makes it into a lever, and easily removes the rock. Well, since he behaves like that, isn't it justifiable that God takes the screwdriver and loosens his brains a little? Some people who are great speakers, great orators, sometimes suffer great lapses of memory and are not even able to say one word. This is how they are humbled. If God constantly allowed one to be a great orator, and then he became very prideful about that, what would happen to him? It seems that God finds a way to put the brakes on each person so that he may not be harmed. So it depends on what you're good at. What you're good at is probably going to be what God will use to humble you when he loosens your screws because of your pride and self-reliance. Sometimes a little twist is all it takes. Sometimes it takes a little bit more, I guess. We must be very careful not to claim the talents given to us by God as our own. We ought to thank God for them and be concerned that we use them to their full extent. When we see a person who's lacking in something, we should say to ourselves, if that person had the gifts God has given to me, he would now be a saint. So the idea here is that whatever gifts God gives to us, whatever they are, whether they're practical, or whether the world considers them practical and useful and honors them, or whether they're gifts that the world doesn't honor and consider practical, they are given to us for one purpose and one purpose only, and that is to work out our salvation. We're going to be tempted by pride in either case, whether the world appreciates the gifts that God has given us or whether the world doesn't. In both cases, we're tempted by somewhat different kinds of pride. People who are good at things that the world doesn't value are just as much in danger of pride as people who are given gifts that the world does value. And in both cases, once we begin to rely on those gifts, our ability to do what it is that we're good at will go away. So if we look to someone who is lacking in gifts, we should say to ourselves, if that person had the gifts God's given to me, he would be a saint. Whereas I have not fully utilized the gifts that God has given to me in order to be humble and put my gifts at the service of others. And furthermore, by my pride, believing that the gifts are because I'm so great and better than other people, I have wronged God by claiming as my own what he has given me. Has anybody experienced any of this? First time I ever experienced anything like this was when I was in high school. I was terrible at school. I hated it. that the last 3 years of high school, I took advanced composition, and it actually was intended to be taken once, but I was such a terrible student, and yet the teachers thought that I was performing under my capacity, you know. So they gave me a break sometimes. They put me in an accelerated English class, even though I didn't belong in an accelerated English class, on the basis of my grades, you know, because I never did homework. I can say this now because all you guys are out of high school. You know, I never did homework. If I passed, it was one just on the basis of what I picked up. I used to say I learned most of my math trying to figure out what grade I needed to get in order to get out of that grade into the next grade, and there was a certain amount of truth in that. But there was one class I liked, and that was writing, advanced composition. But what I learned during the course of learning to write poetry, I learned a lot by writing poetry. I mean, when you're a teenager and you're full of passion and emotion, if you can harness that and bring it into poetry, into language, there's a lot to be learned there. And one of the things that there is to be learned is that if you get too confident in your ability to do the best you can do, all of a sudden it stops. So I learned that probably first in writing. When you do your best work, you're doing something that is actually beyond what you can take credit for. And I think it's that way in most walks of life, you know, not just art, but craftsmanship, study, business. If you're getting up to the limit of your capacity, the thing that is going to bring you down is pride, and that I think it's the case across the board. So you learn to be humble in order to succeed at a level that you could not succeed without humility. I feel like I know that firsthand. So I relate to what Elder Paisios is saying here in that kind of way. Is that way in pottery?
Yeah.
Or are you just relying on your expertise? It's like if you're pushing beyond. You know, I think it's that way in any kind of real learning. You're pushing beyond reliance on what you had before. Or you don't learn anything you didn't know before if you don't do that. Does it not apply to pottery?
Every time I go to do anything with pottery, I get pretty humbled.
And yet your stuff is gorgeous.
It's getting better, but it's more and more beautiful.
No, it is. No, other people think so. Well, that's the other thing. This has come up before. It's only other people who are able to appreciate our gifts without it messing us up. And then we have to be humble about their appreciation because we know how bad we are. You know what a bad potter you are. You know, and I know that I can't just depend on myself. There is something in the work that makes you better. That's how I understand it. If you serve the work beyond your own vanity, it can actually make you better. That's what it seems to me is the case. And you can do things you never thought you could do. It's almost like you're not the one that did it. Make any sense?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I've found.
I've had some experiences with something maybe a little different, but I think it's just kind of the same. But I had a job working somewhere in the past, and there would be somebody who was more like a handicapped person. People would see him as a handicapped person. And, you know, so I'd like, well, let's go out to eat sometime or something like that. Try to befriend them and do things with them and stuff like that. And then I'd run into other people that I knew out in public with this person who was a little mentally slow or this or that, you know. And I found myself like feeling kind of like, oh, what are they thinking now? Why? you know, why is Steve hanging out with this guy, you know? So I realized, and I think about it later, and I was like, Lord, what is this pride, you know, that I'm somehow, I think I'm better than the person I, that somehow I went down to somebody else's level to take, to offer them a chance to go out to eat with me, like, some, like somehow I'm better than them, you know? And it's just like, what is, you know, Lord forgive me, you know, what is that pride, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't need, yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, seeing that ugliness in myself, you know, it's like, Lord, I'm sorry that, you know, it's like, first I thought I was really doing something good, then I realized, well, there's a lot of pride in me that's doing this.
You know? I've found that people think differently. Yeah. I mean, we think we have a standard, a scale of intelligence, and who's better than the other ones. We have a system of grading and all that sort of thing. So people think it's objective. I don't really think that's true. I think there are so many different ways of using your mind, and people, you learn how to use your mind and your abilities. Everybody has to learn that for themselves. Nobody's exactly the same as another person. And along the lines of the fact that it seems to me that people are that different, much more different than we realize. People who the world would consider, and medically and according to the scales of measurement that we have, are, like, as you say, slow or what do you call them? A retarded.
Yeah.
Then that label is put on them. Once you get to know somebody like that, oftentimes you are just incredibly surprised, yeah, by the insights that they have that you would never expect them to have.
Yeah.
They're observant. They experience life in a way that is different from the way people who experience life who never give a, just don't, are not, there's a focus somehow, sometimes, to such people. And I have a cousin who's a friend of mine, you know, is like that. And I have always valued him because of the certain purity of, now I'm not saying he's a saint, I don't think he is, because I could see ugliness in him, we all have it, you know, but there's a certain purity and directness of thinking that he has that can be just like a laser as far as cutting through nonsense or stuff that people try to put over on each other, seeing through the falseness and phoniness of society. I mean, it just comes naturally to him. And so you realize that you're in the presence of somebody that is aware in a way that not everybody is. And I think there's different things going on inside of people, oftentimes people that the world does not value. There's something going on in them that isn't necessarily going on in people who the world values, that the world values as being more useful, more successful.
Yeah.
But if we label people, we just can treat them like they're all kind of objects and not real people. We don't find that out about anybody.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Talents are not always the talents. No, we don't always understand all the talents that people can have.
Right. But it's just kind of eye-opening when you're ashamed to be doing the thing that you felt so good about doing. It's just like,
yeah, the pride was Lord, making you feel pretty good about yourself.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden, you know, then I realize, oh, in this situation where I run into somebody else with this person, I realize a lot of why I'm choosing to do this is out of pride, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean I shouldn't be doing this. It just means my heart needs to be changed, you know. My heart needs to be changed big time.
Well, I can think of situations like that. Like, I was very good at drama and speaking in high school. And I remember after high school, I got to my speech classes, and, you know, having been, you know, thinking to myself as, oh, well, I'm so good at this, you know, I don't really need to, I'm past this, no problem. And Well, I found the first speech I got up there, and I found this is, man, there was time limits on the speeches, you know. Yeah. And man, I went way over that time limit. And the reason was, yes, when I was up there, but I was basically babbling up in front of the class, you know. So yes, I knew what I was talking about, but it was not ordered in such a way as to make it within the time and concise and understandable. And boy, that took me down quite a peg. I mean, after that, I actually started having to practice, and you know, I realized that, well, I don't really have all this.
Yeah, if you had continued to be prideful, you would have rebelled against discipline and not learned anything. That's the way it works. That's the way I found it to be. The pride puts a line. You know, you can't go beyond that. Only humility will take you beyond that, make it possible for you to go beyond what you were able to do before. You may not even be able to be as good as you were before, what you thought you could do, that you took for granted, something exceptional. El Horacio says, we make ourselves miserable when we are prideful. We make God feel sorrow and pain for us. We look down, I'm on top of 97 now, at others as if they were ants, and we trouble them with our arrogant and prideful behavior. So when we're looking down at other people, we don't notice our arrogant and prideful behavior. We would deny it. It's remarkable. Now I'm jumping down into the middle of the next paragraph. We should say, and now further down, have I met and fulfilled all the things God has granted to me, all of the things that I am enabled to do, the reasons that God gave the talent to us that we did? Are we just coasting on that talent? If one does not examine things in this manner, he is in reality an unjust person in the world, because he does not wrong just other people, but God himself, who gave him gifts for a particular spiritual purpose, not for us to lord it over others. But when he does examine things in this manner, he does not allow himself to imagine that he has achieved anything, because he attributes everything to God. And he measures himself as to whether he has responded to all that God has given him. And this is very, very much the same sort of thing as this, when if we're spiritually striving and ascending and becoming and coming closer, you know, moving beyond where we are, and you know, closer to God, we won't notice. Pride does not have the opportunity to take root so long as we're moving beyond where we are. You know, and ascending. It's when we turn around and look at ourselves and say, hey, you know, I'm pretty good, then we're dead. That's it. Not going to go any further. Not even going to be able to do what you did before. So this is how it works. Combating pride. We have to combat pride, or we won't be able to go any further. It like freezes us up. And then finally, end of the chapter, page 98. When one attributes everything to God and becomes a grateful servant of God, doing that ascending that we're talking about, we hear in the other life, well done, thou good and faithful servant, thou hast been faithful over a few things, namely those gifts that I gave you. I will set thee over many things. What many things? What do you think? That's a little vague. Battle's over, race is won, you've been, like St. Paul says, I will run the race to the end. And then it's not a matter of the exercise of gifts anymore, it's a matter of the fact that we now have a permanent relationship to God that was achieved by the longing for and the striving for to go beyond ourselves, to love God and others. And you know, there's that kind of striving. I mean, it's not, it has an end. It comes to an end. That's one way of interpreting it. The Blessed Theophylact would probably give us two or three more, but that's one anyway. Okay, chapter, now this is part three. It's always difficult for me to figure out exactly where I am in this book because of the way it's divided up. But this is part three, so this is a new part. We have now finished part two. Part two, Pride, the Root of Evil, was made up of four chapters. Pride, the Staff General of Passions. Chapter two was Pride is Multiformed, Multifarious. Chapter three was The Consequences of Pride. And chapter four, which we just looked at, is Combating Pride. So now we're in a new part three. Condemnation, the great injustice. Condemnation of others is never justified, according to Elder Paisios. Only God judges justly because only he knows our hearts and knows the hearts of others. We, ignorant as we are of God's righteous judgment, judge others by their appearance, which is why we misjudge and wrong them, because we don't know what struggles they are fighting. We don't know what battles they're involved with. We judge them according to whatever it is we should be doing, but aren't, because we're busy judging them instead of doing it. You know. Chapter 1, and how many chapters are in this part 3, but there are several chapters, and chapter 1 is Judge not that ye be not judged. Condemnation is filled with injustice. Yeranda, okay, and this is Elder Paisios used to visit the nuns of the monastery that he founded. He founded a nun's monastery on the mainland across the water from Mount Athos. I got to visit there. It's where he's buried. I got to visit where he's buried and visit the monastery and talk to some of the nuns at the monastery. Probably not these nuns, you know, but a following generation of nuns. But this is one of the ones that he used to come and talk to, and they collected all of the times that he spoke to them, wrote them down, recorded them, and made them into these books, into these five books that we have. Actually, I think there's at least one more, even beyond this book five. And there's at least one more. Yeranda, which means elder, basically. Yeranda. I am too quick to judge and condemn others. And his response is, the ability to judge is a gift given you by God. Why would God give us the ability to judge? So we can judge others, right? No.
So you can judge yourself, I guess.
So we can judge ourselves. But the devil takes advantage of this gift of judgment and drives you to sin by condemning others. And he makes a it's not just to judge ourselves. There are circumstances where
you need to judge yourself from being in danger.
So what's that?
I said judgment often will prevent you from being in danger.
That's true. Yeah, and that's a consequence of what I have in mind, and that is that, you know, he'll talk about the purification of our judgment so that we can see others and see what their situation is and recognize it and judge rightly about it, but not condemn them. Because the condemnation is never warranted. So even that if we see that there's something wrong, we have no right to condemn. Because after all, we ourselves are not doing.
So you're saying that you might be able to judge others so that you can help or sympathy?
See what the situation is, actually, clearly. But we can't do that until our judgment is purified, is what he's going to say. You should not trust your own judgment until it is purified and divine enlightenment has come to you. When one whose own judgment is not yet purified judges other people, he falls constantly into the sin of condemnation. So purified, you can recognize a situation in another person's life, maybe use it to help them, maybe encourage them, maybe protect them in some way. but not judge them. Whereas if our judgment is not yet purified, which means it would be selfish, self-oriented, comparing ourselves to others to their disadvantage, that's not a purified judgment, and it will lead to condemnation. Such a person will fall constantly into the sin of condemnation. I thought that was interesting. It's easy to miss. That he is saying that judgment is a gift, but it's not to be used to condemn others. That's unjustified. He's still responding to the nun, and he says to her, "You are convinced that you always judge correctly," so based on pride. "However, your judgment is human, worldly. Try to expel the human element and strive to acquire disinterestedness."
Yeah, that's kind of confusing.
Well, in other words, we're not interested in the sense of who's better, that person or me. Boy, are they falling on their face. They're pitiful compared to me. That's not disinterested. We have an interest, a selfish interest in judging, and we judge that the other person is not as good as we are, and we condemn them for not being as good as we are, because we say, well, this person is sinning, I'm not sinning in that way. We ignore the fact that there may be ways that we, you know, twist and bend things inside of ourselves, things that are dark, you know, that we don't even look at. But if we see something, somebody who's doing something that is something that people ought not to be doing, you know, we have an interest, a selfish interest, in putting ourselves above that person by judging them. That's the opposite of disinterested. If we are disinterested, then we don't do that. We may see a situation, but we don't condemn the person. We don't have an interest in making hay out of the situation to build up our own pride at the expense of another person. What do you think? Okay. Last line. "Only then, after your judgment is purified, spiritual, a divine kind of judgment, the way God judges." Because things are a certain way. You know, things are a certain way. "Only then will your judgment be in accord with the righteousness of God and not with human righteousness." Human righteousness is always going to have an element of this one's better than that one. This one followed, did it the way they were supposed to. Condemn the ones that are not as compliant with human righteousness. There'll be more about God's way of judging, you know, in the rest of the chapter. The righteousness of God has the love and compassion of God and not simply human logic. "Only God judges justly because only he knows our hearts. We judge others according to the appearance of things. We misjudge and wrong them. Human judgment is a great injustice." And he will give an example of this kind of thing. "We can never know how things are exactly. Years ago, there was a devout deacon in one of the monasteries on Mount Athos. At some point, however, he put on worldly clothes and returned to his home. Many fathers said various things against him, but what had really taken place? Someone had written him that his sisters had not yet married. And concerned that they might be led astray, he went to help them. He started working in a factory and lived even more as a monk than before. As soon as he had provided for his sisters, he gave up his work in the factory and went to live in a monastery again. When the abbot noticed that he was very familiar with the rubrics of liturgical life and obediences, he asked him where he had learned it all. The monk opened his heart to the abbot, who in turn informed the bishop, who immediately ordained the monk a priest. After being ordained, the monk went to an isolated monastery and lived a very spiritual life with a great deal of asceticism. He attained a holy condition and assisted many people spiritually. However, there are some who are not aware of what had happened and may still be condemning him on the basis of the appearances. He left the monastery, went into the world, worked in a factory, abandoned monastic and spiritual life because they didn't know the whole story. We can never know exactly how things are.
Well, there's a little note down there that what he had done was
This example refers to an action which, according to the canons of the church, now what are you talking about?
Yeah.
That's
leaving the monastery like that.
The elder referred to it in order to emphasize how a judgment according to appearance only, no matter how correct it may seem, can still be unjust. Yeah, okay, right. So he's concerned that we shouldn't take this as an example and just say, I'm going to leave what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm going to leave my, you know, and just do, you know, some practical good work. Okay. Good enough. I think the point
is
still there.
An example, not a guide.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. But I mean,
the example is not an example.
Pointed it out that it was the people who were condemning him.
Were condemning him unjustly.
Well, that they were condemning him because.
For appearances.
Because the canons say you're not supposed to do that.
And either. According to appearances, that's all. That's the beginning and the end of what he was doing, and that what he ought not to have done.
Right.
But there was more to it than that.
Yeah.
More was more going on than that. Mm-hmm. You don't know the whole story. And when the monk opened his heart to the abbot knew that he had left a monastery and gone out to do these things, but he returned. Inside, he was still living as a monk, even in the factory, which is not what you would necessarily expect when a monk leaves the monastery and goes to work in the world.
Well, the abbot was probably doing something special too in allowing him to return, you know, saying, okay, I'll take you back, and then not only I'll take you back, but they made him a priest. So it was...
Probably it wasn't the same monastery, I don't think.
I think it seems like it was a different monastery, but then the abbot of the old monastery, I think, found out right through, because he was given the message.
The bishop.
The bishop.
So the bishop is involved here.
Yeah, it had to have been either a different monastery or a different abbot, because the abbot didn't know why he was so familiar with
all the rubrics.
Right. The bishop doesn't come into it until after the new abbot recognizes his value. I mean, that was the reality of what was going on inside of him. An action which, according to the canons of the church and ecclesiastical order, cannot be considered to be correct. Right. So, yes, he did do what he ought not to have done, but there was more to it than that. It's a matter of the difference between order and obedience externally and the internal reality in a person's heart. The canons of order are not everything.
But that there's, it seems to me like a main thing to see here is just how many were looking down on his actions.
Right.
Even though they were saying things.
I mean, he was constantly a monk internally.
Yeah.
And eventually was recognized because of his constancy. You know, it's not like he, you know, abandoned spiritual discipline when he went into the world. Outwardly, appearance-wise, it seemed as though he had, but actually he hadn't. So, I mean, the canons, you can't use canons to govern what goes on inside.
Yeah.
And yet, you have to have them, of course. You know, canons of order, ecclesiastical order. How careful we must be not to condemn. How much we wrong our neighbor when we condemn him. In reality, we don't just wrong others, but ourselves with condemnation when we condemn someone else. Because when we do that, God turns away from us. And so we've hurt ourselves by condemning others. It's like it stops. So it's comparable. It reminded me of the way anger stops love. When we're angry, we're not loving. You know, it's like they can't occupy the same space. And condemning others, you know, when we condemn others, we lose God's attention. We lose involvement in the spiritual life, you know. That stops. There is nothing more loathsome to God than condemnation. For God is just. Just, not just looking at appearances, but recognizing the realities of things, taking everything into account. Whereas condemnation is rife with injustice. So condemnation is never just. Discipline is possible without condemnation. How we arrive at condemning others. Yolanda, why do I often fall into the sin of condemnation? Because you are too concerned about others. You scrutinize others and what each one is doing. By doing that, you're only gathering material for the evil one to work with, allowing him to lead you into condemning others. So by scrutinizing others, paying more attention to how what they're doing, is it right, is it wrong, look at that person, see how they act, we're building up material, ammunition, bullets, he calls it in other books, that we can use to condemn others. It's hard to read this and not feel really guilty. For me, anyway. You see the faults of others because you are blind to your own. Oh, and the nice thing is that when we're seeing the faults of others, we don't see our own at all. I mean, we feel better. We feel superior because we're not looking at our own faults. We're looking at the faults of someone else. Yolanda, where do thoughts of condemnation come from? They come from the high opinion we have of our own self. In other words, from pride and from our tendency to justify ourselves. We know all the ways of justifying ourselves. We don't know anything about what's going on inside of another person. We don't know anything about their experience except from the appearance of things. So we feel justified in condemning them. But we don't condemn ourselves. Instead, we use all of the details to justify ourselves and to avoid condemning ourselves, to avoid judging ourselves. And there are always excuses, you know. We go to confession and we spend all our time giving the reasons why we did what we ought not to have done. We haven't confessed, we haven't even felt that it was wrong. It was justified by all this other stuff. You know, and then we all automatically have a tendency to put it in the context that lifts any guilt from us. And basically, it's other people's fault that we do things that we ought not to have done. We're always innocent. But when we look at others, they're always guilty. So, condemnation. Yolanda, is condemnation void of love? Certainly. It not only lacks love, but also it contains insolence. Insolence. What's it? You know, do we have a definition of insolence? Insolence is kind of popular and looked on positively today. So as a result, people are not familiar with what it is exactly.
Is it like disobedience?
It's something a little more subtle than that. Anybody?
It's like being rude to somebody else.
It is being rude.
And maybe it's in a small way, you know, so that it's almost, you can almost get away with it, you know, saying something mean to somebody.
It can be pretty.
And derisive to them.
It can be pretty.
And
strong.
But doing it so that people, you can kind of get away with it, you know. In other words, you're not so bold as to say something outright, completely mean, you say it and it hurts them a little. It hurts the other person a little bit, but they don't necessarily come back with something nasty.
What did you find, Jake?
Let's see. We've got a couple here for insolent. boldly rude or disrespectful, contemptuously impertinent.
Okay,
insulting.
Contempt is an important part of it, I think.
Insulting. Yeah, brazen, contemptuous.
Insolent. Condemnation is insolent. Insolence, it puts us above the other person. Sometimes the person that we ought not to do that with. You know?
The Latin is what? Departing from custom.
A lot of that is valued today. Because you can actually, it gives you an advantage among people.
So in other words, you could be insolent in
to your own advantage.
No, insolent not just by words, but by actions. Like,
sure.
Like somebody offers their hand to shake your hand and say hello, and you just ignore it. You know, that would be an insolent type of reaction. Ignore their request for friendship or what, or greeting.
When you look at the faults of other people and lower them, and it lowers them a notch in your thoughts, and justifies insolence. The devil pushes you into making more mistakes if you do that, because you're on shaky ground. I mean, you're not living in the realm of reality when you're insolent. You're relying on your own superiority in a situation where, if it's insolence, then you're on shaky ground. I mean, that's part of what insolence means. It's inappropriate. So you're going to make more mistakes because you're living out this fantasy of superiority, which is no more than your insolence in a situation where it's the way you are acting rejects the reality of the circumstances. If you're not honoring what is worthy of honor and being insolent, well, if you're not honoring something that is worthy of honor, then you're not recognizing the reality of things. Because you should be humble, not insolent. And being in this condition of fantasy and building yourself up, you're going to make more mistakes. And one thing that will happen is that you will again condemn the other person and again behave with insolence. And so it builds, is the point. Sometimes, Yolanda, I get upset with the sister I work with and I judge her. Do you have any idea how many devils that sister might be struggling against at that particular time? Perhaps she was being attacked by 50 demons who were trying to make her fall, so that you would say, that's what she is, judging another person on the basis of their falling under a spiritual attack, and saying that's what that person is. And actually, it's a person who's struggling. When we're struggling, we expect other people to have sympathy for us, you know. They don't see what we're going through, and mostly, unless there's a person of unusual insight, they don't. What we're going through doesn't make any sense to other people when we're struggling. Sad fact. And then, when the demons see that you have condemned her, 500 of them will attack her at once in order to make her fall in front of you again, so that you can condemn her even more. So it's like the exact opposite of the help that we could be to other people who are struggling in some kind of situation. A third of the way from the bottom of the page, page 104. So you condemn and can't contain yourself from speaking out. And you'll say something like, "Sister, did I not instruct you not to put that over there where you put it? Your behavior has scandalized me." Well, that's it. The devil has done his work. He not only led you to condemn her, but also to estrange yourself from her. And she, not being aware that you yourself were the cause of her carelessness, will feel guilty for scandalizing you and slip into sorrow. See how cunningly the little devil works his evil and how easily we cave in. This is the reason we mustn't judge anyone. We should only judge the devils who were once angels and ended up being demons. So the point here is that we're all involved in spiritual struggle if we fall into something that we ought not to have done. Other people can't tell that the struggle is going on. We know when we're struggling, but we can't see when others are. And by judging others, we make things 10 times worse for them. The demon leads people into making mistakes and doing strange things. He puts judgmental thoughts into another person's mind so that person condemns them. Thus, he triumphs over both those that err, make a mistake, and those that condemn. And while those who are led into, it just breaks things up. What do you call it? There's a word that means demonic. It means to break things up. What is it? Go ahead.
Diablo.
Well,
diabolic.
Yeah, it means to break things up. And while those who are led into making mistakes feel guilty and repent, those who condemn justify themselves. So the condemnation hurts the person who does the condemning, possibly even more than the person they are condemning. Person who does the condemning of another person justifies themselves, becomes prideful, and ends up with the same downfall as the evil one. Pride. So these are ways that judging others puts us at the mercy of pride. Yorondo, whenever I have a negative thought about another person, is it always considered condemnation? And Elder Paistios doesn't answer yes or no, but he does give the answer. Do you not understand your thoughts at that time? Sometimes I'm slow at fully grasping them. You should try to be aware of your fall as soon as possible and seek forgiveness. Okay, what was his answer, yes or no?
Yes.
Both from the sister you condemned and from God. Didn't you understand what you were thinking at the time when you had a negative thought about another person? Is it always condemnation? Well, of course it is. You should have understood your thoughts at the time. Well, sometimes I'm a little slow. Okay, so you're asking. How could you even ask? Didn't you understand your thoughts when you had them? You should try to be aware of your fall as soon as possible. Seek forgiveness, both from the sister and from God. Otherwise, this becomes an obstacle to prayer. Condemnation automatically dispels the grace of God and immediately creates a sense of estrangement in your communication with God, not to mention the other person. How can you pray when the heart becomes marble, a block of ice? Okay, page 106. Would there be? Go ahead.
Our monastics in this situation at a different level of something? Let me just say it.
I don't think so. I think it happens just exactly the same way in parish life.
Because I was just thinking about,
it's a more intimate relationship, maybe.
Well, I was just thinking about how he says, you should try to be aware of your fall as soon as possible and seek forgiveness both from the sister.
Other person.
From sister you condemned and from God. And it's like, if you had a negative thought about a sister.
About another person.
About another person. It's like, God, forgive me for having that thought. Does this mean that I now go to that person and said, I had this thought about you? I mean, that's what I missed.
No.
I didn't,
Better that you had the thought, you didn't do anything.
Yeah.
We're talking about thoughts here.
Right.
It's true, monastics focus on the confession of thoughts to a starosta. In fact, people will try to find refuge from things that they have done and not confess them, and in parish life, I mean, with a priest. But instead, they will talk about what's going on through their minds and ignore the anger that they showed to someone, the words that they spoke, the way they did somebody a bad turn. And they'll become so focused on themselves and how they feel bad, and I'm not good enough person, I feel bad about it, I tend to do this, I tend to do that, and what did you do? I want to know, okay, so what was that? And I'll ask him as a priest, what did you do? In confession in a parish, a priest focuses on the confession of sins. And not being monastics, not having the kind of the same environment as in a monastery. In a monastery, you can say, okay, well, I mean, they're monks. They don't break any of the commandments. Well, they might have an opportunity to eat too much. Food in monasteries oftentimes not that bad.
Sometimes
pretty good. Sometimes it's bad.
Pretty basic.
Sometimes it's pretty basic.
But I love it.
I mean, I saw fat monks on Mount Athos. You can't hide that. All the monks know. So the situation's different that way. But in society out here in the world, the way we act and treat others, that's our spiritual discipline. So if we want to retreat into talking about what's going on in our minds, aren't we ignoring all those things that we did with other people? Those are the things we need to be focusing on. So the situation's different. But it still does apply to us, because as you think, so you shall live, right? If you have a negative thought about somebody, you don't have to be in a monastery for that negative thought to bear evil fruit. Next thing you do, you're going to start treating that person as though they deserve to be treated less because you've had this negative thought. So we do struggle against negative thoughts, but it's because those negative thoughts are connected with how we act toward others in the world. So, but the focus is on the things that we do. That's why we don't have to have a monastic starosta in every parish for confession, because our spiritual life is pretty basic. We're mean and nasty to each other. we gossip about each other. You know, that's an act. Gossip is spiritual murder. We judge one another, and we act out that judgment. So,
we do ask each other for forgiveness.
Oh, sure. Yeah, because it's the only thing
that can
change things. Hopefully more than just that once a year.
But yeah, not necessarily having to confess bad thoughts or something,
right.
You still ask for forgiveness without having to have them explain what you're doing.
And insight into the fact that what goes on in our minds is that we think badly of somebody and we condemn them. Confess that, because it directly affects the attitude we have toward other people.
Sure.
And
but not necessarily to that person.
Not to that person.
Yeah.
Even in this case. Are you focusing on the fact that he told her, ask her for forgiveness?
Yeah. Right.
You know, I oftentimes, whenever kids come up and they say, well, I conked my sister, did you ask her to forgive you, That's important.
Yeah.
But internal stuff, not as much. Or is the idea that...
I think it depends on the level of awareness,
yeah.
Which is usually apparent. Sometimes people will ask me to tell them their sins. It's pointless. If a priest does it, ordinarily they are treated to self-justification almost immediately. But it's very foolish for someone to tell anyone what sins you are apparent to you about them. Because as Elder Paisus tried to explain to us, our judgment is not going to be based on insight into the mind and heart of the other person. A man like Elder Paisus knows the mind and heart of the other person.
It seems to me like if you were having bad thoughts about somebody, you could go and like you said, the awareness and go to confession.
They may not know you have bad thoughts.
But that's what I'm saying. You could go to confession, but going to that person and saying, oh, please forgive me, I've been having bad thoughts.
I really thought you were terrible.
Yeah, right. That seems to me more like it's like at that point you're tempting them.
And you're being aggressive. How are you so pure that you're going to be able to do that and not have it be an attack?
Right. So that to me would be why you don't do that.
Yeah.
So if you're having bad thoughts about somebody and you recognize it, yes, go and confess.
Ask God to forgive you.
But that's on you. Don't bring the other person into it because they're not in it at that point.
I think it ought to be part of our standard daily practice. Mm-hmm. You know, to turn away from bad thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And confess them. Ask God for forgiveness and move on. Don't get fixated on them. I am such an evil person that I had a bad thought. I've got to immediately go to confession or I can't go to communion. No.
Well, at that point, you're sinning again, aren't you?
I think so, yeah. Why are you sinning again?
Well,
it's vanity.
Yeah, right. I mean, I would have said an aspect of pride, I guess. Which
yeah,
is,
pride, know. Sure.
Vanity is an aspect of pride.
Yeah. So that's why. Okay, top of page 106. Condemnation and backbiting. What's backbiting? Not a word that you see much. Talking behind somebody's back in a vicious kind of way. Is that sufficient?
Sure.
That backbiting?
Seems similar to gossip, almost.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe a little more.
Stabbing
vicious.
Somebody in the back with,
yeah,
with words.
Backbiting you, maybe condemning someone mm-hmm. in the presence of somebody else.
Yeah, yeah.
Grumbling about somebody.
Yeah. To somebody else. Yeah.
That sounds right. Condemnation and backbiting are among the greatest sins. Gossip is spiritual murder, the monks say. They separate us from the grace of God. Far more than any other sin. St. John Climacus says, as water puts out the fire, condemnation expels the grace of God. As soon as one condemns another and does not face things in a spiritual way, he develops a low-grade spiritual fever and is gradually weakened. And the nun confesses the sin of gluttony. And Elder Paisios uses it as an example of how it can be an impediment, something that stands in the way of being delivered from the sin of gluttony if we condemn others. This is how he goes about it. Yolanda, I often fall into the sin of gluttony. Look, you must take heed that you not condemn. That's his analysis. If you do not prevail against condemning others, you will not be delivered from gluttony either. Since the person who condemns dispels the grace of God, which you're going to need to deal with your gluttony. If you haven't got it, you're not going to be able to. If the person who condemns dispels the grace of God, he will remain helpless and unable to prevail over his shortcomings. If he does not understand his error so that he can be humbled, he will continue to fall. But if he understands his error and seeks the help of God, then the grace of God will return to him. Okay, gee whiz. Maybe I shouldn't eat and watch the news at the same time. What hope have I got?
Always condemning something on the news, right?
Yep. Page 107. When one condemns another for some mistake and does not realize that he himself has fallen and must repent, he will usually make the same mistake. Then he understands his wrongdoing. What is this came up with Kathy? What happened?
Oh, she said she...
Is that an inappropriate example to bring up?
Yeah, probably. I don't know. You made it in front of us, Jacob and I, so...
Well...
Yeah, but over the washing machine overflowing, she said she...
Oh, yeah.
She gave Rachel a hard time.
The washing machine overflowed because Rachel overloaded it.
Right, she thought it was because Rachel overloaded it, but then...
Happened to her, too.
She just did the same thing, and it overflowed again, which means it may not be because you overloaded it, but...
Well, how we applied it here, because we were all reading.
It happened right to her right after she...
It's funny that the same thing happened to her that she just condemned somebody else for.
And she became aware of it.
And she felt bad about it.
Yeah.
She, you know.
Scott's saying, you know, hey, look at that.
Elder Poiesis gives an incredible example. Our loving Father allows that a person duplicates the condition of the one he has condemned in the first place. To help you, I will share a personal experience of mine. When I was in the holy monastery of Stomian, this is not on Mount Athos, this is somewhere else, I learned that an old classmate of mine from grade school was leading an immoral life and causing havoc down in Konitsa. I started praying that she come to the monastery so that I could have a talk with her. In the meantime, I had selected and isolated certain passages about repentance from sacred scripture and from the fathers. Then one day she showed up with a couple of other old women. We talked and she seemed to understand what I said to her. From then on, she would frequently come to the monastery with her child, bringing candles, incense, and oil for the church. At one point, some pilgrims I knew from Konitsa told me, "Father, that woman is a hypocrite. She brings candles and incense to the monastery, but in town, she continues to carry on with the officers." The next time she came to the monastery, I found her in the church reverencing the icons. I yelled at her, "Get out of here! You've disgraced the entire area." The poor woman left in tears. A short while later, I began to experience a strong carnal war within me. "What is this?" I said. "I have never had such a temptation before. What is happening?" I could not find the cause. I prayed and prayed with no results. So I took the uphill path to Kamo, which is a mountain that looks like a camel, near that monastery. I thought to myself, it would be better if the bears ate me, because he can't get rid of this completely unfamiliar spiritual internal attack. I walked deeper into the forest as I climbed the mountain, but the temptation did not subside, so I took out a hatchet I had tucked into my waistband and struck my foot 3 times, thinking I could overcome the temptation through the pain. The shoe filled with the flowing blood, but to no avail. At that moment, the woman came to my mind, and I remembered the words I had spoken to her. That's when I said, "My God, I only lived this hell for a few moments, and it is unbearable." What hell is he talking about?
His thoughts.
Carnal desire.
Carnal desire. Okay.
"But that poor woman is in this hell constantly. Forgive me for condemning her." Right there and then, I felt a divine freshness, and the war ended. Do you see what condemnation can do? And there's a quick note down at the bottom to point out to us that using a hatchet to get rid of our temptations, not a standard practice, but the elder, in revealing this event as a confession, was also making known his disposition for martyrdom, to reject the welfare of the flesh in order to fight these temptations. And this, the editor says, the motivation to face his temptation was not hatred of the body, but rather love for Christ. And under no circumstance would Elder Paisios have recommended to anyone to confront a carnal temptation in a similar fashion. In fact, I think Elder Paisios is giving it as an example of what a miserable and unspiritual condition he was in. He was desperate, not used to this. It's completely unnatural for him to have this desire he'd never had before. So that's an example, and this is all because of the fact that he condemned this person. And justly, right? I mean, this woman, this two-faced woman is coming and bringing things to the church and listening to spiritual talks and reverencing the icons in the monastery as though she's a righteous person, and actually she's living this wanton life in the world. So, according to a worldly justice point of view, Elder Paisios was perfectly right to yell at her. But that's how God dealt with it. Gave him the same struggle, battle to fight.
Well, there's the olives. I like that story about the olives. Okay, olives, and then to the last page. Sorting olives, I thought this was good. Bottom of page 108. Yolanda, today I passed judgment on some sisters who were sorting olives because I noticed that they weren't being careful in their work. They were missing some bad olives. And his advice to her is, put aside your judgments, because later God will also judge you. Now, we're not talking about judging the olives. We're talking about judging people who are not doing a good job sorting the olives. That's important. Don't you ever place a bad olive among the good ones? No, Garanda. I am very careful not to do that. Well, if Christ does such a good sorting on the day of judgment, then we are all lost.
Yeah, I thought that was good. I like that.
I like that.
That was like, wow.
Page 110, last page of the chapter. If worldly people will go to hell because of their abuses, spiritual people will go to hell because of their condemnations. But we can never say that anyone will go to hell. We do not know how God works. The judgments of God are an inscrutable abyss. Because one reason that I can understand is that, I mean, we talk about not knowing the whole situation in somebody's life, but when it comes to what is being talked about here, in order to be able to take the whole situation into account, you would have to be able to take the whole of all time and space into account. And then, if you were spiritually minded, you might be able to see where it made sense from God's point of view. But it probably won't ever make sense from a worldly point of view. Is what I thought when I read that. We should never condemn anyone, for by doing so, we usurp judgment from the hands of God. This was Job's lesson at the end of the book of Job. Where were you when I created the world? How are you in a position to know what's going, you know? You're not in a position to judge. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.